And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. In the first, you're going to be meeting a very impressive young woman from Park High School who is currently an apprentice engineer with Delta Hawk Engines. We'll be talking with her, with two representatives of the Racine Unified School District, and with two people from Delta Hawk, a very exciting young company. In part two, we'll be exploring the life story of a man who has had to live with some very serious phobias. Here's part one of today's program. I am so excited about the next few minutes here on WGTD, and I want to be sure to say a thank you to Mary Beth Zolke, who brought to my attention a really exciting program at Park High School and reconnected me with Jeff Wilkins, who I've known for some time, who is a school counselor there, to talk about the exciting story of a junior at Park High School, Aubrey Marquez, who is a student in what's called the automotive pathway. And she has been doing an apprenticeship at Delta Hawk, which is such an exciting young company. And we will talk about some of the incredible innovations that they have helped develop. And really at the heart of that success have been some great people and some marvelous young apprentices, including Aubrey Marquez. So we're talking today on the morning show, first of all, with Jeff Wilkins, school counselor, Aubrey Marquez, student at Park, and then several people who are involved in this in some other ways. Mike Lynch, who also is with Racine Unified, is the youth apprentice coordinator, particularly working, I think, with the youth apprentices at Park. And then two folks join us from the company, from Delta Hawk, Lisa Booker, who is head of HR, and Erin Nito, who is one of their engine technicians and someone who has very directly mentored Aubrey. And first of all, a warm welcome to all of you to the morning show. Thanks for making time for this on a busy Thursday morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jeff, let's begin with you and just find out a little bit about this sort of overall program and, as a school counselor, what your connection is with it.
Sure. As a school counselor, I happen to be the counselor in the automotive construction and robotics pathways in the Academy of Business and Technical Services here at Park High School. And of course, we're looking at helping students get career and college ready. And that's the beauty of the youth apprenticeship program, is it helps in both areas, college and career. I've seen so many students that get their foot in the door at a company or get hours that they get in high school that will count for their apprenticeships after high school. I've seen students that stay in school and don't quit because of their youth apprenticeships. So, and one of my jobs is to make sure that they have the credits necessary for graduation, plus the credits they may need for 2 and 4 year degrees.
Very good.
And it's great to see the mentors here, Michael and Lisa, and I haven't met Aaron yet, but I'm glad he's here as well. So thank you very much, Greg.
Good to be talking with all of you. Let me shift over to Mike Lynch for a moment, who is the Youth Apprentice Coordinator. Tell us, first of all, what are we talking about in terms of number of apprentices and the kind of places where they work and what you have to do as coordinator?
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to. So the currently within Racine Unified, we have over 200 youth apprentices for the current school year. And they range from students like Aubrey through business, engineering, manufacturing, different companies locally here within Racine. But ultimately what it is it provides students opportunities to start navigating through a career field before they actually graduate high school. So they're exposed to different pathways during their freshman year, and then towards the end of their freshman year, they'll pick a pathway. This Aubrey, for example, chose an automotive pathway. So she'll take 3 sequential courses. And then the end of your sophomore year, Delta Hawk opportunity came up. They had reached out to us and said, hey, we're looking for a student who might be interested in, exploring these different types of careers. I spoke to Aubrey. She was interested. We went through the whole resume process and, a mock interview. And then she went off and interviewed and here she is.
Nailed it, apparently. Before we talk to Aubrey directly, Mike, tell us what some of the other pathways are, some of the other areas in which a young person might want to pursue something like this, pathways other than automotive.
Sure. So in culinary, construction, manufacturing, engineering, robotics, business, finance, health services is a big one. Health science, another very popular one. So there's a wide range of different pathways for all of our students, and these pathways align within our community needs. So it's a win for everybody. But giving students these different options is really what makes this program work.
Very good. All right, I don't want to waste another moment before talking to Aubrey Marquez, who is a junior at Park High School and someone who has been a youth apprentice at Delta Hawk. Before we learn a little more about that company, Aubrey, tell us a little bit about how you found your way into this program in the first place. I mean, at what point did that happen, and did anything in particular inspire you to pursue this possibility?
I feel like I started off very young. I love being a hands-on person. I've never really wanted to sit at a desk and do boring things, you know? And so in middle school, I did woodworking. And then when I got to high school, I learned about the automotive pathway through my brother, because he went through it. And I thought that would be a really good pathway for me to go into because of, you know, my early interests.
Hmm. So did you have already kind of an interest in tinkering with cars and that sort of thing? Or did you go into this kind of not really knowing exactly what you were getting into?
Yeah. I didn't really have too much of an infatuation with cars. It was more of just the fact that I would be able to, you know, get up and learn new things and work, you know, work hands on.
Hmm. Well, this has certainly been that. And fortunately, there's this incredible company called Delta Hawk that proved to be a wonderful place for you to do some exploration. Lisa Booker, you're head of HR for Delta Hawk. Before we talk specifically about Aubrey's apprenticeship at Delta Hawk, give our listeners a little background on this company, how long it's been around, the kind of things that you do, and maybe touch on the really exciting breakthrough that your company achieved not that long ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you do some research on Delta Hawk, you'll actually see that we entered the industry back in 1996. At the time, it was, you know, two gentlemen that had, you know, such a passion for the general aviation space and getting a two-stroke diesel engine into aviation. You know, two gentlemen, again, very, very passionate about what they were doing, but ultimately they never had the funding or the resources that they needed to get this across the finish line. As I'm sure, you know, the listeners can imagine, it takes a lot of time, a lot of resources, and a lot of money to get something like this up and running and into production. So then fast forward to 2015, that is when the Rood family of Racine decided to take on Delta Hawk as a company and, you know, invest the, again, the money and the talent that it needed to, you know, make this company successful. So that's when I joined back in June of 2015 and literally helped build this company from scratch. Then, you know, a couple years later, we hired Aaron Nito, who is now our lead engine technician. And, you know, he is a big part of the youth apprentice program in mentoring these youths, specifically Aubrey, he's taken under his wing. And, you know, we are very proud now to have, you know, announced last April that we achieved type certification, which is huge for us. What that means is that, you know, we can now begin to actually produce and sell an engine. So massive news. So right mm-hmm. now we are, you know, in that transitional phase where we are transitioning from a startup company to a company that's actually producing and selling an engine. Mm. That's it at a high level. And, you know, Aaron can definitely get into the technical details of it if that's what your listeners are looking for as well.
Mm. So I'm glad that Aaron is with us again, head or lead engine technician at Delta Hawk. And I will talk in just a second about the work you do with Aubrey, but I want to give you a chance to talk about this specific engine, the DHK-180, which apparently is a terrific engine for a couple of different reasons, and no less than NASA found themselves interested in it. If you can, in layman's terms, for those of us who don't know engines like you do, can you explain what's made this engine such a special thing and why this is all so exciting?
Yeah, definitely. So the Delta Hawk is a two-stroke. It mainly runs on Jet A. It also runs on other fuels, diesel. We've done kerosene testing, things like that, which is more readily available across the whole globe. Avgas is kind of getting higher in price, and our engine is way better on fuel economy. Two-stroke is, you know, it's better just because of less moving parts. We're all mechanical. There's no electronics with our engine. We're American made. We source everything here in America, which is big. It's definitely a very robust engine. Like Lisa said, we just got our certification, and that's huge. You know, we did the whole testing in front of the FAA, which the last one that was done was in the 60s. So it was really definitely a big thing. It was definitely exciting to be a part of. You know, we got to do that engine build for the FAA. Like you said, NASA, we got to do that engine build, which was very exciting. And we definitely have a few more people that we're working with currently. And it's getting to be a pretty big deal here.
Right, of course. So how long a timeline are we talking about? I mean, how long has it taken to develop this particular engine and get it, in a sense, ready for the marketplace?
It started in 96, I believe, is when Doug started it. It kind of really started changing a little bit more when the Roots took over because of the funding and everything. I came in 2018, and even from the last 5 years that I've been there, I mean, the engine has dramatically changed. So it's taken quite some time. I think a lot of people don't realize how long it actually does take. A lot of it is a paperwork side of things. You know, you have to have that all documented and tracking everything, where all the parts are coming for. A lot of testing goes into it. But it's been a long road, but I mean, we're here now, so it's very exciting.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the presence of exciting and talented young people like Aubrey Marquez at Delta Hawk. And it sounds like you have worked very directly with Aubrey. So Aaron, tell us first of all, when you first met Aubrey and the kind of things you have done with her.
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of funny because we were looking for to add another apprentice, because I've had Aubrey's now my fifth high schooler that I've worked with. And we closely worked with Horlick before. I asked Lisa if we can maybe venture out a little bit. I heard Park had the automotive pathway, so that would probably fit what we do here at Delta Hawk. So we did. We had a group of kids come in. We had them hand their resumes to us. And we didn't even meet them first, just kind of looked through their resumes. Aubrey stood out. I mean, you should have read that resume. That was better than some of the adult resumes I get. So we, you know, we brought in some kids to interview just one-on-one after the tour, and Aubrey just knocked it out of the park. We brought her on board, and she's gotten to do quite a bit of disassemblies and assemblies of engine parts, full engine disassemblies. Some of the parts that Aubrey's built on her own have actually gone into airplanes that we are currently flying. One just flew down to Florida. If you look at our social media on Delta Hawk Engines, you'll see that whole story. So that's really exciting. You know, as a junior in high school, that would have been really cool to be able to build actual airplane engine parts that actually flew. So she's doing really good here at Delta Hawk.
Wow. Well, and I'm sure you're a big part of that. Aubrey, tell us what a typical day is like. And first of all, how many days are we talking about that you are actually at Delta Hawk? I mean, how does this fit into the rest of your life, and particularly your life as a student? And when you are at Delta Hawk, typically what are you doing?
4 days a week. Don't work weekends. It's not really, open weekends. I do take one day off for my sport. I play volleyball. And then day to day, it kind of fluctuates depending on, you know, what parts we're making, what, you know, what items we have to make the parts. So it can fluctuate between assembling an engine, disassembling, assembling parts, disassembling parts. If they failed, you know, we'd have to look into it and see why, so that that's why we would need to disassemble them. And yeah.
So tell us about your relationship with your mentor, Aaron Nito. I mean, what has that relationship been like? And particularly in the early going, what was Aaron doing to help you along?
So, and I don't really know how to explain it. I mean, he's a great mentor, and he really doesn't let me say that I can't do something. Like, he's always like, you can do it, like, I know you can do it. And so that's really helped with, like, my confidence, and I really appreciate that.
Aaron, tell us about when somebody like Aubrey comes in, how do you know what they are capable of doing and what kinds of things you should be handing over to them?
So we kind of start off a little slow. The best way, I think, for anyone to learn, especially on the engine side of things, anything mechanical, is taking something apart, right? You take something apart, if you mess it up, it's okay, because we're taking it apart, it's not going to run anymore. And after that, you kind of can see how their mind works and what they're comfortable with and what they're not comfortable with. You know, you ask them questions on the way. How did you know how to do that, or why did you do that? You get a feel for it. Aubrey was definitely one of the more advanced students that I've had. I've gotten to trust her with a little more sooner than I have others, which is, it's fine. Everyone moves at their own pace. But you kind of get a feel for their comfort level. You know, like Aubrey said, you know, sometimes she will, I don't know if I could do that, I haven't done that before. And you just got to keep pushing them to, you know, you can do this. You know, I get it. You're okay. I'm right here. If you have any questions, it's all right. And then you kind of just trust them with a little more things as you go, just little tests here and there that maybe they don't know that you're giving them, just to see how they're doing. And, it's very fun to be a part of and see all the students grow, here at Delta Hawk.
Sure. Were you mentored in a similar way? I mean, you sound like a great mentor. Were you yourself mentored? I mean, and are you, in a sense, patterning what you're doing after how you were mentored? Or was your pathway into all of this very different from Aubrey's?
I definitely had some really great mentors in my life. You know, my father started me out very young working on engines and stuff in the garage. And then as I got into it, you know, I started my career as in automotive. And then I moved to diesel trucks, heavy equipment, and every step of the way I had great mentors. When I came here to Delta Hawk, I had good mentorship on kind of learning how everything works around here. And, you know, when I talked to Lisa about this youth apprenticeship program, you know, I thought that would be a great opportunity because I wish I had those opportunities when I was in high school. You definitely get a little further in your career, I think, if you start younger. And, you know, the whole blue collar kind of ordeal is kind of dying. You don't really see that anymore. I mean, mechanics in general, everyone's struggling to find someone that can wrench on an engine. So to see kids like Aubrey that are interested, I mean, we just take them on and let's get it going. You know, it's great to see. So, yeah, I definitely just, like I said, I've had great mentors and, this is a really cool program, so I'm very proud to be a part of it.
I can really, really tell. And Lisa Booker, you were saying before we went on the air that this is one of those stories that's just a win-win-win. I mean, it's just a feel-good story all the way around in terms of being great for Aubrey and these other young people and great for Delta Hawk and essentially great for the public as well.
Yeah, well, in addition, great for the community. You know, a program like this really does touch many different people. And, you know, for us to be involved with a program like this, you know, I think Racine Unified has just done such an incredible job with the Academies of Racine Youth Apprentice Program. And, you know, for companies in the community, I hope that more companies become a part of it because, you know, to be able to get in the schools and, you know, get these students when they're young, they're eager, they want to learn. You know, again, if they have those good soft skills or you know, again, a good character, we can teach them anything that they need to know. And, you know, the other amazing thing for us too is keeping talent within the community. You know, by being able to, you know, actually get into our you know, inner city schools and be able to recruit this talent has just been such an incredible recruiting tool for us. Currently, you know, we do have 6 youth apprentices with us, and, you know, to be a startup company with only 55 employees and 6 of those employees are youth apprentices is something we're really proud of. But, you know, again, as I mentioned to you earlier, Greg, this wouldn't be possible without, you know, again, a supportive leadership team, leaders like Aaron, who believe in this program as well. And then, of course, the amazing partnership that we're lucky to have with Racine Unified.
Very well put. Mike Lynch, I imagine in your position as youth apprentice coordinator, you have seen a whole lot of lives dramatically changed by this kind of story.
It is never a dull moment. I'll put it that way. There are life-changing opportunities here, and the coolest part is when kids, young adults, I should say, that light bulb goes off, and they realize that they can do this. And Mr. Wilkins actually alluded to it a little bit earlier. You know, they don't know what they don't know until you show them. And there are plenty of students that I think we've collectively worked with that. It may not happen until midway through their senior year, where now they have some direction. They've been floundering for a couple of years trying to figure things out. And then, you know, a certain opportunity might come along. I mean, there's plenty of students that just Jeff and I can talk about that, you know, that really help guide their future. So it's definitely one of the more rewarding jobs, I would say, within the district. So I'm blessed.
I'm sure. Jeff, let's get a final word from you on this gratifying story about Aubrey and the wonderful success she's had. I'm sure it does your heart good to see this.
Oh, yeah. And I just want to give a shout out to Mike for all the students he's helped with the resumes. I know Aubrey's was a winning resume when it got there. And a shout out to Aubrey, who's right here, and that she is actually paying it forward in mentoring. I see her when I go into the classroom, I see her mentoring other students and helping them. Right now they're working on a very difficult and challenging unit in electronics. So I appreciate all of her mentoring and paying it forward to others.
Fantastic. So Aubrey, what are your aspirations? Are you hoping to continue to do this work that you are doing right now at Delta Hawk?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, before I wasn't really sure like what I wanted to do after high school. So this has kind of like guided me. So it's like, I don't really have to think too much about what I want to do because I already, you know, have a job with them. And so now I just have to figure out what I want to do with more schooling if I want to pursue that or yeah.
Well, this is a great story on so many levels. And first of all, we congratulate you on the great success you've already had, Aubrey, and wish you only the best as you finish things out at Park High School under the loving guidance of school counselor Jeff Wilkins and Mike Lynch, youth apprentice coordinator. And of course, we also want to thank Lisa Booker, head of HR at Delta Hawk, and Aaron Nito, their lead engine technician, for joining us to tell that side of this really wonderful story. Thank you all for being part of the morning show. It was great to speak with you, and best wishes. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. We explore today the fascinating and sometimes very challenging world of phobias, and specifically what occurs when someone is assailed with very serious phobias which affect nearly every detail of their daily lives. I'm speaking today with Alan Shawn, who is already a well-known writer. You perhaps have seen his work in Atlantic Monthly. He's written an interesting book about composer Alan Schoenberg. And his newest book is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life, in which he talks about the array of phobias which have affected his life for many years, including especially serious agoraphobia and claustrophobia and so on. And he traces some of the possible reasons why his life is one that is lived with the harsh realities of all these phobias and the ways in which he has managed to cope with them and carve out for himself a very successful and happy life. And we speak with him for the next few minutes about all of this. Again, the book called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And Alan Shaun, we welcome you to the morning show.
Very nice to talk with you, Greg.
Looking forward to this very, very much. So you are afraid of many different things. And when we sort of make a list of them, it's really kind of astonishing to realize how much of a full life you've been able to live, despite the fact that you have a terrible fear of heights and water and enclosed spaces and crowds and so on. In a nutshell, how have you managed to do that?
Well, I should say, first of all, that when I talk to other people with these types of problems, they generally unpack a pretty full suitcase of things that they don't like, just as I do. And it turns out that an awful lot of people suffer from not just a couple of specific things that they don't like, but kind of a whole constellation of things that circumscribes their behavior. But yes, like many people, I have tried to carve out a life that consists of the things that I don't need to avoid and that I don't dread. I teach. I'm a composer first and foremost, a pianist. I teach at Bennington College. I teach music. And I also have started to write in midlife. I started to actually write. I first wrote the book on Arnold Schoenberg, and now I've written this book about really a subject that I wish I could avoid, but which turned out to be so fascinating that I did end up with quite a bit to say about it, as you know.
Right. When you are experiencing, I don't know if we want to call it an attack or what,
sure.
An attack of agoraphobia or one of these other phobias, for instance, I mean, you have great difficulty, for instance, if you have to drive over a bridge or in a tunnel.
Yes.
You cannot ride on a subway.
Right.
When you have these attacks, is there something tangible that you are afraid will happen to you? Or is it more of a kind of an unnamed and an unspecific sort of dread which you experience?
Well, people tend to think of these types of reactions as being all in your mind. But to the poor sufferer, it's much more like an allergy. You find that every time you go through a tunnel, you have a whole series of physical symptoms, culminating in a lot of thoughts of dread, but it doesn't start by, you know, in a rational way with a thought such as the tunnel's going to cave in on me. It's really much more like a response that you'd see in a cat or a dog or a horse. You want to run, you want to flee. It's the famous fight or flight symptom.
Mm. Well, and you, I know, talk in the book about some of the very real physical symptoms.
Yes.
Which you experience as well. Tell our listeners about the most acute of them.
Well, I think our listeners all know these symptoms, but maybe most people experience them when there's really some danger occurring and they need to respond to it. Rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, maybe a tightening in the chest or even chest pains, perspiring, tingling sensations, to name just a few. And then, of course, the mental experience of being confused and disoriented and kind of frantic, all of which is really physiological in origin. Although, when it's happening to you, you ascribe it to, well, really one of two things. You think that you're physically in great danger or mentally in great danger.
Hmm.
In fact, what's happening is that your body is responding exactly as it should in a dangerous situation, but at the wrong time.
Hmm. I think it's especially interesting that you have a terror for closed-in places. And a fear of wide open spaces, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the wide open spaces reaction is something that only really I noticed when I started to write the book. A lot of these things are so instinctive that I just think of them as part of the world itself, part of life. And I realized, you know, even writing the book, how all of this added up into one giant syndrome that's really a very, very inconvenient, to put it mildly.
Hmm. Part of your book is an effort for you to maybe untangle some of the possible reasons behind your phobias, and specifically some of the ways in which you're challenging childhood. In a child challenging home might have at least something to do with why you live with these serious phobias. Yes. I want you to tell our listeners about the interesting story you tell of your mother and what she would be like in the car when your family would be going someplace. This is a really interesting insight into her and maybe into some of her demons.
That's interesting that you focus on her, because, of course, in my childhood, my father was much more the person who we all thought of as suffering from anxiety and phobias. But our mother was very much a part of that, because she lived exactly the same way he did. In a way, her problems were concealed behind his, which were more obvious. And after his death, she didn't really live particularly differently. And she too, had, an incredible fear of being in an unknown place and not knowing where she was, being lost. And when we would travel to Boston or sometimes through New Jersey, she would always have a map, and she would always be looking at every point along the way. But even going to Lincoln Center from 96th Street and 5th Avenue, she would tell the taxi driver exactly what route to take, where to turn, and she wouldn't dole it. She would dole it out rather slowly, bit by bit,
and politely. You tell us
very politely. Both my parents were amazingly courteous and gentle people, but there was a firm grip there, even on a small journey, as if there were all kinds of dangers out there that you had to be wary of.
Sure. So she would say, the driver would take a certain turn, as she requested, thank you. Now, at the next corner, you will turn right. Thank you, and then on to the next.
Absolutely correct.
Hmm. And, of course, what I suppose might be at the heart of some of your life of fear, if we should call it that, is that if you saw in her this overwhelming need and desire for utter control, then stepping into any kind of situation which is clearly just beyond your control would be a truly frightening thing.
Yes, I mean, we're talking about how basic, instincts can be molded by your upbringing and by your own habits. I mean, of course, we start with our genetic makeup, and I'm sure that in my family tree there's a strong genetic tendency towards anxiety. But then, how you're brought up is terribly important, and you're completely right that having both parents who were monitoring their every move so carefully and not terribly spontaneous in the outer world. You know, they were quite spontaneous and adventurous intellectually, but in the outer world, not. Of course, a lot of that rubbed off on me. But then, you know, you can move beyond your upbringing in so many ways. So the mystery is, you know, why one member of a family becomes very much like his parents, you know, in terms of problems such as, let's say, drinking or you know, anger or other kinds of difficulties people have, and another family member is free of them.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
I wonder, in this life filled with so many phobias, is there a strong temptation for you to confront those things so feared in the hopes that maybe something has happened and maybe you're not going to be afraid of riding the subway, or you're not going to be afraid to go over a bridge or through a tunnel? Or at some point, do you know without even attempting to encounter those things that such a thing remains impossible? And is it possible to really know that?
Right. That's a difficult question. You'd hope that such things might just evaporate on their own. I think the only way to get over these types of habits of body and mind, really, is to have positive experiences doing those things, and to demystify them and retrain, really, your very brain to respond differently to those experiences. So there's, yes, I mean, I've never stopped pushing myself, although, you know, everybody who knows me wishes I pushed myself more. But, of course, I keep trying all kinds of things in an effort not to discover that I no longer have the responses, because they're so ingrained, but to bit by bit chip away at the habits. I'm really talking about habits that are ingrained in, you know, in the brain itself, to create new pathways in the brain, which sounds, you know, fanciful, except that's exactly what really the experts in the field recommend.
You are, as you mentioned, a music faculty member. I should have certainly mentioned that. I happen to be a music professor myself.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. And you are a composer.
Yes.
And of course, one of the things that I'm sure has been especially painful or frustrating for you is the fact that it is tremendously difficult for you to be, for instance, at public concerts, even those where your own music is being performed. And it's hard to think of a more unfortunate scenario than someone who creates music for just such occasions which either you cannot attend yourself or can only do so with sort of gritted teeth and grim determination. Has that become any easier over the years?
Well, I have, you know, ways of turning up at places that are, you know, highly enjoyable, and then there are situations that I simply can't bear. I mean, if I'm, you know, if I had a piece played at Lincoln Center and I could sit on the aisle, there's no problem with that for me. I have a joyful experience at such occasions. But if I have to take a plane or if I have to take an elevator to, you know, to even the 10th floor, the very same experience would be very difficult for me. And even driving, as you suggested earlier, you know, a few hours to a place I haven't been before to hear my own music, I would have to practice the drive as if, you know, as if there's something really difficult for me in the drive itself, and in finding my way there, which is even to me astonishing, but it's the truth.
I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately, and I'm trying to remember this for certain. I believe you are or have been married.
Oh, yeah.
And have a family. That part, for some reason, was a little bit vague in my mind. And
right, because I don't really bring my personal life into the book much. I deliberately avoid.
Right. I mean, you talk about how, in a sense, you wanted this to be both a personal and impersonal book.
Yes.
And I thought it was for a very laudable reason, because, in a sense, you don't want people so caught up in some of the specific personal details of your own life that they can't sort of see themselves or use the book to help themselves with their own lives and their own particular situations.
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, I was married for many years, and I was divorced, and I'm now remarried. I have two children, and I'm actually, believe it or not, expecting a third child in July, even though I'm about to turn 60.
Wow.
So, you know, my life is very eventful on the family plane.
Right.
I didn't want the book to be a memoir in the traditional sense. It's about 50% memoir. But I thought there were, because some of the members of my family are quite well known, I thought that it could easily be perceived as basically a book even of gossip. And I wanted it to be about personality and the origins of the many quirks we all have. Mine are, you know, really regrettable and pretty serious, but I think everybody has a personality and has sides of themselves that are mystifying to them. I would almost say that 99% of what we do as we go through our day is mystifying to us.
Hmm.
And I was trying to go deeper into that rather than to just talk about people who are well known. So actually, people reading the book don't even notice that I do not use names in my book, for the most part, except for my sister. She has a name, and that was for a very specific reason.
This is a sister who is institutionalized?
She is. She's autistic and mentally retarded and suffers from schizoaffective disorder. And she is my twin. And the story of my sister sort of surfaces in the book as really equal in importance to my own story. And a big part of maybe the pain and difficulty behind my current problems. And to be honest, talking about mystification, that surprised me. As I was writing the book, I found that emerged. And
You mean your deep feelings about her and her,
yes,
being institutionalized, and yes, that occurred at the age of 8.
Yes.
So this is a sad circumstance with which you have lived for many, many years.
For many years, and of course, certainly highlights the issue of traveling in a very different way than one might at first expect.
Hmm. We have just passed the 20-minute mark, but if you would permit me,
yes,
I would love to just have a brief word from you, if you have the time, to just tell us, if you are comfortable, just a little bit about what it has been like to create your own family within the framework of a life that is riddled with these phobias. I guess what I'm curious about more than anything is if you have managed to do that more easily than maybe you would have anticipated at the outset. I mean, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I've tried to be more honest with my children than my parents were with me about these things. It's a different time, and there's a lot of candor in the air these days that was not there in the 1950s when I was growing up. So I've tried to be honest with them about the difficulties I have, and I've encouraged them to be adventurous in many ways that I have not been. and to try to take from me whatever my good points are. Also, my two children, who are now fairly grown up, 19 and 23, you know, their mother is a world traveler and a completely different type of personality, so that's benefited them wonderfully. I mean, being a parent is participating in life, you know, and in evolution, I recommend it. I recommend it to everyone, and I don't think that having these types of handicaps and other kinds, for that matter, should make people there think they're not possibly competent parents. I think everyone has their difficulties, and if you can bring up your children with some honesty about that, and that people are not as depicted in the glossy magazines, and are in fact very complicated and often, almost always flawed, I think you can bring up children who are able to face their own lives.
Sure. Well, and I suppose, I mean, if I'm sure this impacted family life in many ways. I mean, you probably couldn't, assuming your children were musicians, it was probably difficult, if not impossible, for you to attend most or many of their functions, for instance. But for them to have to come to grips with that and understand your own weaknesses or the difficulties with which you were contending,
right,
that's probably
right.
Good for any young person to be sort of wrenched out of their own desires and think about someone else and their struggles, even if it's your own father.
Right. You've spoken truthfully. I mean, obviously there's that tug of war between difficulties I have and the needs of others, and tug of war between a sense that this is a character flaw and something more, like a medical disability. And that's just the way it is.
The book again is called Wish I Could Be There: Notes from a Phobic Life. It's published by Viking, and a fascinating book start to finish, and its author Alan Shaun. Alan Shaun, I'm so glad that you have written this book, and I'm sure it will be of tremendous help to anyone who lives with this reality, and I think will be tremendously interesting even to those who thankfully are not living with this sort of reality in their lives. We all have a lot to learn from your very interesting story, and I thank you today for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your interesting book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg, and to you.